Welcome to the deep dive. This is where we take the sources you send us, all the articles, the research, and we really try to pull out a framework you can actually use.
And today, we're tackling the big one.
The big one. If you're trying to keep up with this incredible technological shift, you know, this whole abundant intelligence revolution, and you feel like you just need a map.
You're in the right place.
Yeah, you're in exactly the right place because the ground is definitely moving.
Oh, it really is. And that tension, we see it perfectly in that one line we keep hearing over and over. Someone told us they overheard it at a coffee bar.
Right.
I've never felt this much behind as a programmer. There's a magnitude 9 earthquake rocking the profession.
A magnitude 9 earthquake. And that feeling, that's not an exaggeration for a lot of people. The tools are just, they're moving faster than anyone can learn them.
Exactly. Yesterday's expertise can feel like it's about to become tomorrow's commodity.
So our mission today isn't about giving you know, hot takes or 6-month predictions.
No, we're looking for the patterns that last. We're going deep on three major ones. We're calling them the three rabbit holes.
The rabbit holes, I like that.
And they offer a kind of a reusable framework for navigating a world where intelligence is suddenly abundant and cheap.
And what's so interesting when you look at the sources is that this isn't totally new. Humanity has gone through these massive efficiency shocks before.
We have. The patterns we're about to unpack, you can see them in 19th century coal consumption, of all things. You could even see them in how Amish communities decide on new technology.
It's all connected.
It is. So we're structuring this around three areas you really need to get your head around. First is discovery, how you see what's needed.
Okay.
Second, efficiency and abundance, which is this huge paradox of why making work cheaper actually creates more work.
The big counterintuitive one.
And third, collective resilience, which is, how you survive a shift that's just too big to handle on your own.
All right, let's dive into that first one, rabbit hole one, discovery and signals. The big question here is, how do you see an opportunity before everyone else does, before it's obvious?
Well, the sources give this really powerful contrast. Picture two people, one person, they just keep optimizing their current job, right? And eventually their expertise gets commoditized and they end up maybe as a Walmart greeter.
A simple non-growth role.
Right.
Huh?
And the other person, they see a gap and create something totally new, like the person who starts a YouTube channel teaching kids all the practical things a dad might teach them.
That's such a specific example, but I totally get it. It fills this need you didn't even know was there. But that gap in vision feels huge. You can't just decide to have better ideas.
But see, the data suggests it's not about having a better brain. It's about access to the right signals and being set up to process them.
Okay.
The YouTube dad problem wasn't solved by someone having a lightning bolt idea. It was solved by someone who had the space and the structure to actually notice that very specific unserved need while everyone else was just scrolling past.
So how do we do that? Practically, I mean, what are the mechanics we need to build into our work?
The sources point to three things. First, you need deep pattern recognition. That comes from broad experience. Second, cheap experimentation. You have to be able to try things without it costing a fortune.
And the third?
And this is the most important one. You have to be embedded in the communities where the needs actually exist. You can't see what's really needed from 30,000 feet.
That one hits home. It's the opposite of just running a big market analysis report. You have to be in the mud, right? With the people who have the problem.
You have to be in the mud. And if you can't spin up a quick test, a tiny prototype for basically no money in an afternoon, you're not in the discovery game. If the cost of failure is high, discovery is basically zero.
And there were two amazing concepts in the sources about this. The first one was the Amish method. It sounds old-fashioned, but it's a brilliant strategy.
It's the ultimate long game. They don't just reject technology, they make it go through this like collective evaluation. Sometimes they wait 50 years.
50 years.
Yeah. They essentially use the rest of us, mainstream society, as a giant beta test. And their main question isn't, how efficient does this make us?
What is it?
It's, what does this do to our relationships?
Wow. Relationship impact over efficiency. For a modern business, that is a radical idea. It forces you to look way beyond next quarter's results.
It's a total inversion. And the second concept, boredom as infrastructure, is about your own headspace. If you optimize every second of your day, you fill every gap. You actually destroy the quiet you need to notice the signals.
The space is the infrastructure. So discovery isn't about a better to-do list. It's about building in the capacity to just observe.
Exactly. If you're never bored, you're too busy running yesterday's playbook to see tomorrow's opportunity.
That is a perfect transition into rabbit hole too,
Yeah.
efficiency and abundance, because this might be the most misunderstood part of this whole shift.
I think so, yeah.
Everyone assumes, look, if AI makes my job 100 times more efficient, we'll need 99% fewer people doing my job.
But history shows that's just fundamentally wrong.
And this is where we have to talk about Jevons' paradox.
Yes, the cornerstone of all of this. Okay, let's go back to 1865. James Watt. He invents a new steam engine. It's 8 times more efficient than the old ones.
Okay.
Now, if you ask anyone what happened to coal consumption in Britain, they'd say it must have dropped,
Right.
right? You're using less fuel to do the same work.
Logically, yeah, it should have gone way down.
It rose 18-fold.
18 times. How?
The moment you make a resource that much more efficient, you crash the cost. When you crash the cost, you uncover all this latent demand that was just sitting there, hidden, because it was too expensive before.
So the activity itself just explodes. It becomes viable for millions of new users and new uses.
It explodes. So applied to knowledge work, if AI makes writing code cheaper, we don't write less code. We write 1,000 times more code, more analysis, more content.
Okay, so this isn't just one effect. The sources mentioned three different rebound mechanisms that cause this.
Right. The first one's the simplest, the direct rebound. AI makes writing reports cheaper. So
Yeah.
you write more reports, maybe 10 to 30% more, just because you can.
That one's easy to see, but that doesn't get you to an 18-fold increase.
No. The second is the indirect rebound. The time and money you save on those reports, you don't just, go home. You reinvest it. You put it into other knowledge work, deeper research, better presentations.
You just redeploy the savings into more complex tasks.
Exactly. And the third one, this is the big one that's almost invisible.
The economy-wide rebound.
Yes, cheaper knowledge work makes the entire economy more productive. GDP goes up. And a bigger economy demands more knowledge work across every single sector.
And there's actual data on this. For every 1% gain in efficiency you get, what was it?
A 0.7% net increase in consumption. The net result is always expansion, not contraction.
And this plays out in the history of computing. The sources trace these five waves, and each wave was something like 100 times cheaper and bigger than the last.
Think about it. Wave one, mainframes, millions of dollars. Only a huge bank could afford one to do payroll.
Right. Then wave three, the PC, a few thousand dollars. Suddenly, an individual can do desktop publishing. A whole new category of work appears.
And now we're in wave five, the AI agent layer. Tasks cost pennies. So you're democratizing the power of a Fortune 500 company and giving it to a 10-person startup.
Which makes needs visible that were just unthinkable before.
Exactly. The sources had that great example of a barbershop owner in the 1970s. He had accounting needs, sure, but a mainframe was a bridge too far. It was economically impossible.
But once that capability becomes a $20 a month subscription, suddenly every small business owner in the world needs business intelligence.
And that's why you see this massive job-to-task shift.
The marketing example was perfect. Digital tools made marketing tasks 100 times more efficient.
And yet marketing employment went up 5 times.
Because every small business could suddenly afford to do it.
The job of typesetter from the 70s didn't vanish. It became a task, a button, and a bigger, more strategic role, like brand manager. The work expands by getting absorbed into other jobs.
This gets to that quote from Aaron Levy, the CEO of Box. He said, "The real leverage isn't in maximizing R, the return, it's in bringing down the cost of I, the investment."
Yes. Traditional strategy is all about big bets. But AI collapses the cost of entry. It collapses the cost of getting expertise, the cost of execution.
And the cost of risk. You can fail cheap.
You can fail cheap and try again tomorrow. Think about that customer dashboard project. Before, it's a $100,000 6-month project, a big risk.
A huge investment.
Now with AI tools, maybe it's $6,000 in 3 weeks,
yeah.
A 15x reduction. Suddenly, hundreds of projects that were bad ROI are now no-brainers.
So you're not just optimizing your old work, you're unlocking a whole universe of new work you couldn't do before.
That is where the growth comes from.
So, if intelligence and execution become cheap, abundant commodities, what's actually scarce? What holds value?
The sources point to 4 things. The first is wisdom.
Not just intelligence, but wisdom.
Right. AI is great at answering, how do I grow my business? It can't answer, should I grow my business, even if it hurts my community? That's judgment. That's wisdom.
Questioning the premise of the problem itself. Okay, what's second?
Context. All the unspoken stuff, the emotional subtext, the history between two people on a team. AI only knows the 20% you type into the prompt. It misses the other 80%.
That deep, tacit knowledge. The third?
Relationships. Trust. Mutual stakes. AI has no skin in the game. It can simulate a relationship, but it can't build real trust over time.
That's non-transferable. You can't just copy and paste trust. And the last one?
Embodiment. Just being there. Physical presence. It's the ER doctor who walks into a room and just knows something is wrong before the charts even say so.
And the thing that links all four of those, wisdom, context, relationships, and embodiment,
is that you have to participate. You can't extract them. You can't automate them with a prompt. You have to show up.
Which brings us perfectly to the final rabbit hole, collective resilience. Because the trap for so many people is trying to optimize their way out of this alone.
The AI blues. This feeling of permanent anxiety because you're trying to personally keep up with a change that's bigger than any one person.
You can't do it alone.
You can't. The solution has to be collective. And this brings us right back to the Amish model. Their whole strategy is based on collective well-being, not individual efficiency.
It's a total reevaluation of where value comes from.
It forces you to choose between two models. On one hand, you have task-based value. That's, I'll design your logo for $5,000.
It's a deliverable. It's replicable. It's competing directly with AI.
Exactly. It's a race to the bottom. But on the other hand, you have relationship-based value.
Which would be what?
That's, I'll be your design partner for $25,000 a year. I'll make sure your brand stays coherent across your whole leadership team.
Same work, maybe, but the value is totally different. It's based on the context you've built, the trust. You're irreplaceable in a way the task doer isn't.
Your value is resilient because it's tied to those scarce things. Context, wisdom, relationship.
So let's tie this all together. What does this framework mean for you listening right now? The scary story, the AI will take all the jobs story. It's just missing the point.
It's missing the Jevons paradox. AI democratizes access. That creates more demand, which creates more total work. The shift isn't about the amount of work.
It's about the type of work. It's a shift from individual expertise to collective capacity.
From one-off deliverables to ongoing relationships.
From extracting value to participating in it.
Which gives you a very clear, very strategic question to ask yourself on Monday morning.
Does my value exist in the tasks I perform or in the relationships I hold?
And if it's task-based right now, the advice is clear. You have to intentionally start adding those layers that AI can't touch. Add context, add wisdom.
And if your value is already in relationships,
double down. Go deeper. Build the kind of trust and context that makes you truly indispensable.
The final thought, then, is that the winners in an age of abundance won't be the ones who are best at using the tools.
No. The ultimate strategic position belongs to those building that deep, participatory, relationship-based value. The people who are still focused on purely extractive, task-based value are choosing to compete directly with the technology that scales infinitely. This transition, this whole earthquake, it's not about mastering the tools, it's about rediscovering where human value truly lies.